Shalom and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. We welcome you to these podcasts, which explore some of the issues and events that are impacting ourselves, our families, and the Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution on aging. And we invite your comments and suggestions to Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook, or on the JewishSacredAging.com homepage. You can leave a voicemail message at JewishSacredAging.com with suggestions, ideas, comments, etc. And we welcome to the microphone and to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, Harriet Cabelli, the author of Living Well Despite Adversity, subtitled Inspiration for Finding Renewed Meaning and Joy in Your Life. Harriet, how are you?
Hi, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
And you're from the beautiful part of New York. It's Long Island. Are you in Long Island?
Yes, I am. Not far out.
All right,
West
good.
West Hempstead.
Well, okay. Well, welcome. Welcome to Seekers of Meaning, and we have lots to talk about. Living well despite adversity. Let's get to the tachlis right away. How does one get a hold of this book?
It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble online, and it's on Amazon.
Okay, so the great God Amazon continues to
the great God, yes.
Well, it works. Amazon works. Tell me about the title. Why that title?
That title has actually been a theme of my life since I don't know, about 18, 19 years old. I've always thought, I know it sounds strange, but I've always thought about this idea of how people, in other words, that it's a given that as part of the human condition, we're all going to go through bad times and losses and problems and bad things. So it's not so much how we can avoid it as once it's there, which is kind of inevitable, how do we live the best way we can despite? So because since we only have one life, we have to make the best of it. We're going to have issues. How can we live well despite adversity? I mean, it's really always been, I don't know how it came about, but it's always been a real interest of mine.
So this is sort of like the book is a collection of reflections, essays, personal vignettes organized around some themes and carrying with it in each one of these rubrics a series of questions that are posed to the individuals who wrote essays.
To be specific, it's interviews. I have a collection of 36 interviews that I did over a 3-year period, one a month, highlighting people who have transcended their losses and adversities and been able to come through it and continue on, perhaps in a new way, but to rebuild their life and still live a rich life despite. So it's 36 interviews.
How did you get these people? Did you put an ad in the paper? Or?
No. I love reading, and I'm always on different websites, and I read book reviews, and I love memoirs, and I love stories of uplift and inspiration and these type of transcendent stories. So I kind of look for books like that. Mm-hmm. And when I would come across a new book or an author, I would reach out to that person. So a lot of them are through their books, through their personal memoirs that they wrote. And some are just here and there, however I got it from an internet. Someone introduced me to someone I saw at the JCC on the Upper West Side. But I would say for the most part, it's through their books.
So you in the beginning, give reference to Dr. Martin Seligman, the progenitor of the positive psychology movement. Tell me about that influence on you.
Well, I took a certificate program in the field of positive psychology up at Kripalu, which is in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. And Tal Ben Shachar, he's from Israel, but he gave one of the most popular courses at Harvard on living well and positive psychology. He was the main professor of this year-long course. And obviously, taking a course in positive psychology, you're going to be learning a lot of Martin Seligman, since he's, like you said, he is considered the father, perhaps the grandfather, but I think the father of positive psychology. So I reference him. I reference a lot of Viktor Frankl because he's one of them also from way back, and he's one of my favorites. And his book Man's Search for Meaning, I mean, to me was life changing. So those are some of the people that I reference in it.
In a lot of the interviews that you talk with people, they talk about their journey, their personal. It's all about their personal journey. And there's a theme as you read through the book and you read through the interviews. In essence, one of the things that struck me is this power of resilience, human resilience. So one of the questions I wrote down when as I was reading through this is in your opinion, is resilience hardwired in each of us, or is it something that you have to learn?
So it's both. We're all born with a certain amount of resilience. It's part of our genetic makeup. We have our strengths. But having said that, there are clearly are people who we could say have more or less than others. Like sometimes I'll have people say, well, you know, you're just born like that. You're just naturally strong, or you just naturally have a lot more resilience than I do, or something to that effect. So yes, we're hardwired for it, but we are also able to increase our resilience because research is now showing that it is like a muscle and it is a skill set that can be learned. In fact, a lot of schools are now bringing in what they're calling resiliency curriculum into schools beginning in kindergarten. Some term it emotional development, social emotional awareness, or resilience, but it is they're showing that it is a skill set and it is something that we can build on. So whatever it is that is our set point of resilience, we can increase it. We can grow it.
So you wrote this. Do you go around? Do you do speaking engagements, lectures on the book and this whole philosophy of resilience and your own particular journey? Is that something that you do? And if so, if somebody wants to talk to you, how do they get in touch with you?
It is absolutely a passion of mine. It's a key interest of mine. And yes, I've been doing book talks and talks on specific topics, resilience, emotional intelligence, known nowadays as EQ, mindfulness. I mean, all of this stuff is kind of incorporated, I would say, into resilience. And in terms of talking about my book, I talk a lot about specific themes that I've gleaned out. Besides resilience, purpose and faith and other things that stand out based on the interviewees. And in terms of how you get in touch with me, through my website, through an email, through a phone, I'm up there on the internet. And when I Google myself, I'm always surprised to see how many things I have up there. It's like surprising to me. It's funny.
What's the website?
RebuildLifeNow.com.
One word, right.
How do we incorporate or integrate our loss or our challenge or our adversity into our lives and then rebuild it? Basically rebuild, incorporating our struggle, incorporating what we've been through. So it's about rebuilding.
So I met one of my buddies in your book. We hang out every once in a while together and discuss great theological issues such as the Philadelphia Phillies, and that is and that is Danny Gottlieb. And it was very lovely to meet him again and see him in your book. And I know Dan and some of his writings, and we've actually done programs together. Talk to me about, and he expresses the power of love.
Yes, he was actually, I'm pretty sure he was my first interviewee after I had read a couple of his books. He's such a beautiful writer. The power of love and the power of listening and just being with the person, even if it's in silence. That's what really struck out for me when I spoke to him and then when I was writing up his interview. The unconditional love to human beings, no matter what situation or who they are, and the amazing power that just being still with a person in pain can have, because we're always thinking we have to talk, we have to give advice, we have to move in and try to fix it. But he has some beautiful lines about just being, just sitting with that person is comfort and healing. Because really, as human beings, what do we want? We want to be heard and understood and known for who we are as a human being. And I think his interview stresses a lot of that with beauty, because he's a beauty. He expresses it very beautifully.
Yeah, he does.
Much better than I'm saying.
Yeah, he does. He's an unbelievable neshama. And actually, I'm very happy to call him and very proud to call him a friend. You also have a section in one of your interviews to talk about the right questions to ask in dealing with someone dealing with serious illness, and actually not, I'm around if you call me, if you need me, but actually being very proactive of saying, when's the best time to do your laundry? When's the best time to bring you dinner, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about some of that.
Right. That Letty Pergreben wrote a book on her experience with breast cancer, and her take on it was how to be a friend or how to be a support to someone going through, in her case, an illness, but I guess you could expand it and say in terms of any difficult situation. So it was an interesting, very interesting perspective. We often don't think of it like that. So to be specific, we'll all say to people, because we don't really know what to say when we're trying to be there for a friend or a family member in a crisis. So we'll say, I'm here for you. Call me when you want. But that's not really helpful. And this is what she speaks about, because when the person is going through their own situation, their own challenge, they're not going to go rise up and start thinking clearly and start saying, well, let me see. I think that person, Joe, said he would do this, and Sally said she would do that. Let me call them. I mean, we can't leave it up to the person who's going through their difficulty. So we, as the support system, it behooves us to be more proactive, as you say. And if we know them, then kind of foresee their needs and step in. And like you just said, I'm coming to do laundry. When is the best time? I'm bringing dinner. I'm going to pick up the kids. Are you interested in having visitors? I'd like to come. Let me know when I get there, if you want me to leave. In other words, being very in tune and in touch with the needs of the other. Of the other meaning the person in crisis or in trauma, and being very specific as opposed to just sitting back and using that generic statement, I'm here for you, right, or give me a call when you need something.
One of the more—
does that explain it?
Yes. One of the more really touching and profound sections of the book I found was this section that you're dealing with individuals whose children have died, or have been murdered or have been killed. And in one of them, I think Sherry Mandel's interview essay, you write about something called PTG, post-traumatic growth, which I found to be very, very interesting. Could you just— you write about it as a concept whereby we can be positively changed by our struggle with loss, adversity, or trauma. It goes beyond resilience, the ability to bounce back. It occurs when we create new meaning as a result of tragedy. Post-traumatic growth. How did you arrive at that particular phrase? Is that your phrase? Or?
Well, no, it's not my phrase. Oh, I only wish. No, it's, again, I learned this through my studies of positive psychology. It came out in the 1990s through these two professors I think it's the University of North Carolina, but I'm not exactly sure. I have it written in my book. I don't want to misquote it, but I don't have it in front of me. In other words, everybody was always discussing the concept of post-traumatic stress, which obviously is a very real thing, and it's as real today as it ever was. But they started researching and seeing that there were people who were really able not just to bounce back, which is really what resilience is. Resilience is the ability to bounce back and come back to ourselves. But post-traumatic growth goes a step beyond it. It's not just bouncing back, but it's becoming almost more than we were before in some way, be it within ourselves, our values, our actions, or be it more in an outward appearance. People take on more religiosity, more spirituality. People founded organizations. They go on to create foundations, all different types of things. Now, in other words, it doesn't have to be where someone is doing this extraordinary thing. Not everyone's going to go create an organization like Sherry Mandel did. She's the mother of that 13-year-old who was killed in a cave in Toccoa years ago, and she went on to found the Kobe Mandel Foundation, which is a healing retreat and camp for people who've gone through, who have family members and loved ones who've been victims of terror. And she brings people in from all over the world, clowns and all different types of things. She and her husband created this foundation. Not everyone is going to take a loss, take their personal loss and do something huge like that. But we can still have our own growth in a less obvious way. And if I could use myself for a moment, my daughter is a miracle, and she went through a medical crisis and nobody thought she would live. And not only did she live, but she's fully recovered. And, it resonated with me tremendously, this post-traumatic growth. And I ended up, and I took this positive psychology course years after I went through this with my daughter. And I found that it was like an eye opener. It was like an aha moment for me, because I said, well, this is really what I've been going through, but mine was much more internal. I developed a much greater sense of urgency and interest in life, and realizing the fragility of life. And if we don't take it on when we have it, that it's just going to go by us. Because as I sat with my daughter when she was on a respirator, listening to every beep and bleep, I thought, oh my God, there but by the grace of God go I. And if this isn't going to motivate me to live well, then nothing is. And that became I feel like when I heard this term, it was like a light bulb. It was, oh, this is my internal shift. So it could be internal. It doesn't have to be, like I say, a huge thing. Someone starts a foundation, or like John Walsh started the Missing Children Foundation that he did on the milk containers. You know, when his son was kidnapped and murdered. So people do big things and people do small things, and people don't do anything, but they go through internal shifts. So that's the idea of a post-traumatic growth, the idea of going beyond and almost living or feeling like your life is even more meaningful because you're doing or acting or being or feeling differently, but in a positive way. And that's not to take away grief. You know, we kind of can hold the two together, but we can still transcend.
We're speaking with Harriet Cabelli, the author of Living Well Despite Adversity, subtitled Inspiration for Finding Renewed Meaning and Joy in Your Life. The website is rebuildlifenow.com, and the book is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble websites. You have an interview essay with Meredith Vieira, who writes about the power of being open, openness, the idea of not being afraid to talk about exactly what's going on. And she channels in one of the other interviews, too, about not being afraid to have humor, not to lose a sense of humor in the middle of these journeys. Could you just reflect upon this sort of like duality of being open, not being afraid to be open, and not losing your sense of humor?
Yeah, and you know, the being open idea is the elephant in the closet, and we all have elephants, and we open the closet and they all come pouring out. So at some point, they show themselves. And she was referring a lot in terms of her three children, raising her kids while being a caretaker to her husband, Richard Cohn, who has MS and then had several bouts of cancer.
Right.
And she's someone who, she's the person, I think I said at the beginning of the interview, who I met at the JCC on the Upper West Side and actually went over to her and asked her and invited her to be an interviewee, and she graciously said yes. It was like amazing. Anyway, so yeah, the idea of being open with her children and with friends and with support, because how do we get the support that we need if we're not going to let it be known what's going on in our lives? Now, not everyone wants that. Some people, we have to respect their privacy, and they're not of that ilk, and that's okay too. But her take and her perspective, certainly in terms of raising her kids through this, and this was a life, I mean, this was throughout her kids being raised, that he was, that he had an illness and had doubts. So the only really way to come through something in a healthy way, I shouldn't say the only way, but one of the ways, is just being vulnerable and being open to what's really there, so that then we know what we're dealing with. We know what, like the beast, the elephant, what it is we're dealing with, so we can cope better, as opposed to just poo-pooing it or pretending. Or, I mean, kids have huge antennas. They know things are going on. So certainly in terms of raising kids, we really need to be open and honest, and that only gives them permission to really feel all the feelings, and that it's, there's nothing shameful and there's nothing embarrassing, because a lot of times we feel shame and embarrassment and guilt and all this kind of stuff. But if we put it out there, it's an emotional help. It's emotionally healing.
Why do you think so many people are afraid to do that? What's holding people back to being open? Is it shame? Is it guilt? Is it fear?
I think it's what's holding back from being open is part of that is being vulnerable. It's for some people, it's a sign of weakness. I have to maintain my outer exterior of strength. I'm okay. I don't need anything. I'm good. I'm strong. I think that's one thing. I think another is people don't want to be judged. But I think those are more negative connotations. But with all due respect, I think there are some people who have it all together and who are making an active, viable choice to say, I just don't want to air it. This is a very private condition, and I don't want anybody really knowing about it other than my immediate family.
Do you see this more generational? I mean, do you think, let's just say older baby boomers, let's say the people between 50 and 70 or whatever, or more private, more reluctant to reach out and say, I'm vulnerable, I need help, as opposed to younger generations? Or in your experience, as you've traveled and written and you've researched, is this just more of a human condition?
I think it's more of a cultural condition. I don't think it's age-based. I think it's more, if anything, it's cultural-based, and it's just human. But I don't think, I haven't found it to be age-based, where the older people would be more, closed, and the younger people would, let it hang out. I haven't seen that. I'm not a researcher, but I have not seen that. I do think from what I have seen, I also worked in the school system for years, just in terms of talking and being open and coming in for counseling, which is a whole other story. Talk about being open. There's a lot of shame. And again, I saw it to be very cultural.
More American, rugged individualism type of culture? That if you...
Americans that are more open, and other cultures that want to keep it all together and closed, and we don't hang our dirty laundry, and nobody else needs to know our business. I mean, there's that. And then there's the whole thing of therapy represents weakness.
Right.
I mean, we're losing a little bit of that stigma, I think.
I think so.
But
yeah.
It's still there. It's still there for, and certainly for some cultures, tremendously, it's still there.
One of the very interesting differences in the essays, the interviews that are in the book, has to do with the concept of self-pity. And you asked, you go through a period of self-pity, and why and where and how did you get out of it? Some people said, yes, I did, because it's natural. And other people said, no, not at all. I mean, What do you make of that?
I think some people see pity as like a very negative thing, and maybe you're afraid you might get stuck there if you get into that spot of self-pity. I don't personally think there's anything innately wrong with it. I think it's normal to feel a certain amount of self-pity, like, why me? And, we go there. I think there's nothing wrong with it. I think the key is, though, being able to move beyond the self-pity And then sometimes humor comes into that. I think one of my interviewees, they talk about a pity party and, you know, like kind of indulge, you know, I'm going to have a pity party, I'm going to indulge. But the key is, do we stay there or do we get ourselves out and move on? That's really the key. There's nothing innately wrong with pity. It's does it drive our life? Are we going to remain there and become a victim? Or are we going to say, yeah, I'm allowed to lick my wounds. I feel bad for myself, but then move on. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Harriet, what's the role of, in your opinion, from your, you know, work and your interviews, the role of faith?
Well, in all of the interviews, I can't even think of faith being not in any one. I think it was all a part of every one, and faith being very general, meaning not based on religion, not based on a god, but just based on a higher power. To every person, I'm pretty sure to all 36, if not every most, there was this idea of faith in something beyond me, faith in something beyond the human awareness. So call it God, attach it to a religion, call it a spiritual power, something beyond the humanism. So that's and that was a key in every interviewee, is the idea of faith and something not necessarily understandable, but something that they're hanging on, that we hang on to, that we hold on to, that's there.
Every interview you track the journey of a human being from a variety of different backgrounds. You track them from a variety of different causal relationships, you know, things that cause these particular instances of resilience, the need for resilience. You write in the epilogue this actually wonderful line quoting Audrey Hepburn, which says, and you say, she says, "Nothing is impossible. The word itself says I'm possible." Impossible meaning I'm possible.
I love it. Isn't that great? Yeah.
That really is that sense of, no matter how difficult, how unfair the situation is, this really sends a message of hope, doesn't it?
It does. It does, because the human being has humongous amounts of untapped potential. We all do. And we use very, very little of our potential. But that was a big part of what I was trying to get across in this interview, in my interviewee's perspective, is that no matter what they were going through, they were going beyond their limits. So Dr. Dan Gottlieb, the person you referenced before, being a paraplegic.
Quadriplegic,
sorry. That's someone else's name. And continuing to do a radio show and doing therapy and being a psychologist. And I had someone in there who was a paraplegic who wheelchaired himself in a manual wheelchair from California to New York. Now, someone would look and say, "Ah, that's crazy. That's hokey. What kind of nonsense is that?" It's not a matter of hokey or anything. It's a matter, the point being, to show that we are much greater than what we think, and that the sky is the limit no matter what our limitations are. We limit ourselves by our mind, by our mindset, by our perspective, and that we have much more capabilities than we're giving ourselves credit for, and can push forward in ways that we would never consider. I mean, look at Christopher Reeve. I mean, there's so many people we could look at. Look at Stephen Hawking. I mean, all of these people used untapped potential that we look at and say, well, that's miraculous. Nobody else can do that. The fact of the matter is, if a human can do it, it means more humans can do it.
Would you say that would be the lesson that you took from these 36 interviews?
One of the huge ones, yep, the limitless potential that we have. And I don't know if I said it in this book. One of Viktor Frankl's colleagues or clients, I don't remember, he had broken his neck. This was years ago. And he referenced him a lot in his book, saying that the quote from this man was something to the effect of, "I broke my neck, but my broken neck did not break me."
Right.
Yeah, I'm paraphrasing.
No,
I don't think I'm destroying it a little. But the idea being that something can happen in our lives, and it could be horrific. I mean, nobody's sugarcoating it, but does it have to end our lives? And I don't mean end literally where we die. I mean end literally where we then succumb and become and just wait to die and do nothing with it because we're so devastated. And some people do. And some people choose assisted suicide, and I'm not making any judgments on that. But my book is showing a different side.
Living Well Despite Adversity, Inspiration for Finding Renewed Meaning and Joy in Your Life by Harriet Cabelli. The website to contact Harriet, rebuildlifenow.com. Harriet@rebuildlifenow.com. The book available on Amazon at the website and Barnes & Noble. Harriet, thank you very, very much for your time and the book.
Oh, thank you.
And
continued
good luck and success. And we wish you well and good health. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. Loved your question.
Thank you. And to all of you, thank you again for listening to today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. This show and all others are archived on our homepage, website, Jewish Sacred Aging. Aging.com, and we invite you to go to the website, sign up for the website, like the Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook, and we welcome your comments and suggestions to rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com, and we also welcome any ideas that you have for writing articles, contributing to the website. We welcome those and look forward to hearing from you. A reminder that Seekers of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin at the studios of Lubetkin Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We thank you for your attention and listening. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you or listening to you again on our next edition of Seekers of Meaning. Shalom.